Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness. Tonight we have informational meeting. It's going to include invited testimony from William, hopefully it's Jager. Mr. Jager is a professor at OSU, and he is going to be giving us information regarding a research project and a paper that he and another professor have put together regarding the economics behind Measure 37. Mr. Jager, I know that you have a limited schedule. We're going to give you as much time as you need. I understand that you have to be leaving the city, so we'll kind of go with your schedule. You're the only presenter we have scheduled for tonight. We thought we were going to have another presentation after yours, but that has not materialized. So I think why don't you come on up, and we'll get you on the record. And I'm not sure what your time frame is, if you want to kind of give us a kind of perspective of how much time you have before you need to leave, and then we'll adjust accordingly.
I think I have plenty of time. I have a 9 o'clock flight out of Portland.
Okay. Okay. Well, our goal is probably, you know, say within an hour, definitely have everything taken care of, your presentation as well as the Q&A, and we'll get you on your way.
That'd be great.
All right. And if you'll be so kind in starting your testimony, go ahead and give us your name for the record, and we'll let you lead off, and we'll reserve our questions unless you want them during the presentation. Normally, we've been waiting until the presentation's over, and that way we make certain that you've covered everything you need to cover, and then we'll ask questions after that.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I could just put on the record that one of our members on the House side, Representative Patty Smith, has a commitment in her district and so will not be with us this evening, and Representative Clem will be arriving late, and they're both excused from the proceedings for purposes of
their
commitments.
Thank you very much, and I also will do the same. I know Senator Schrader has been, let's say, a little bit more engaged with the Ways and Means process as the co-chair, and I expect that he may be coming or going or not, but he also will be excused at this time. Professor?
Chairman Prozanski and McPherson and members of the committee, good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to testify before this important committee. My name is Bill Jager. I'm a professor at Oregon State University in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics, and I live at 3201 Inspiration Point Drive in Eugene. There are many aspects of land use planning and Measure 37 that I have been studying along with a colleague and as an economist and also as a policy specialist in the Oregon State University Extension Service. I'm here tonight to focus on one aspect that is, to me, of central importance with far-reaching implications for the future of land use and land use fairness in Oregon. You all face an enormous, complicated, and politically charged task. I am here because I believe that what I have to say can make that job much, much easier. My issue tonight is how we know if a land use regulation has caused a reduction in a property's value. The way we do this affects everything else about this issue in a profound way. My message is this. Three different methods could, in principle, be used to evaluate Measure 37 claims. Only one of them meets some common sense criteria that I will discuss. But this is not the one that is currently being used in most jurisdictions. So let me give you a bit of an outline of how I plan to go over this material. I'm going to start by talking about some key attributes of each of these three methods relating to this determination. Second, I'm going to talk about a way to consider their relative success in, and by that I mean their success in coming up with the right answer, affirming or approving a Measure 37 claim if in fact that should be the case, denying it when in fact it should be denied, getting it right. What is their success in getting it right? Third, I want to talk some points that may not be obvious. And fourth, then I'll summarize and relate what I've said to some criteria that I think are useful. I'm going to start by talking about the first method, what I call the with and without method. This means taking the value of a property currently or with the regulation and comparing it to the value it would have without the regulation, if that regulation did not exist, and then measuring the change, the difference between the two, is it positive or negative? This seems to be what the text of Measure 37 calls for, but it asks for a comparison between the real world with a land use regulation and the world that would exist if that land use regulation had not been enacted or enforced. This question poses an enormous burden on government, one that cannot possibly be directly and accurately fulfilled. As you will hear, the with and without method that attempts to answer this question directly is impractical. But I want to talk about it because it provides an important reference point for what we would like to know in order to do this correctly, if we could, if we had a crystal ball. The with and without method compares two scenarios, the real world as it actually exists, and the world as it would be if the land use regulation had not been enacted or enforced. That other world is hypothetical, so we have to imagine or create it some way. Economists can do this with economic models. We would want to characterize the many different markets for land in different locations and for different uses. Without the land use regulation, supply and demand would differ, causing prices to change. Changed prices in one market could affect demand, supply, and price in other markets. These changes could affect investment decisions by firms and builders, and also government decisions about infrastructure and public services. Changes in patterns of development would alter open space amenities, congestion, jurisdictional boundaries, and the compatibility of existing and potential land uses. And all of these changes would affect tax revenues and spending. At the end of this process of science, and with some guesswork, we would have an estimate of what the market price of a parcel would be or would have been in this hypothetical world had the land use regulation never been enacted and enforced. And we could then compare that value to its price in the real world to decide whether the land use regulation affected it positively or negatively or not at all. Any such estimate would be costly, time-consuming, and open to challenge by competing models involving different assumptions. It would, however, create quite a bit of consulting work for economists like myself. So method one, the with and without method, tries to do exactly what is called for in Measure 37, but it is not practical and has not been tried or even seriously considered as far as I know. We must use a different method or reject Measure 37 because it asks the impossible. Now I'm going to turn to the other two methods that are practical and talk a little bit about each of those two. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't think I programmed this to go one step at a time like this. My PowerPoint skills are not up to doing this, but somehow. So that's a summary of what I just discussed about the with and without method. Produces the correct result if done properly, but very difficult to do properly. Costly and time-consuming, and really just impractical. Method two is what I call the single exemption method. The single exemption method estimates the change in value for a single property if it and it alone were granted an exemption to the land use regulation. Standard appraisal techniques are used for this method. This method is easy and relatively cheap to undertake, but it is based on flawed reasoning. The single exemption method makes the untenable assumption that removing a land use regulation from one property is the opposite of applying the land use regulation to many properties. Okay? Taking a regulation off of one property is not the opposite of applying the regulation to many property. In fact, adding a regulation to many properties, enacting and enforcing a land use regulation, will affect those markets I talked about in direct and indirect ways. Removing a regulation from one property will not. Because of this, the single exemption method will often produce an incorrect result. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit more with some illustration. Now, this method is currently used by most jurisdictions. Now I'm going to turn to the third method. Method three I call the before and after method. It looks at the market price of a parcel before the land use regulation took effect and compares it to the value after the land use regulation took effect. If the market price declined, this is taken as evidence that the land use regulation caused a reduction in value. This method is also referred to by some as the Plantinga-Jager method, although I prefer to refer to it as the Jager-Plantinga. It is currently used by the Portland Metro Council, and they coined that title. This method is also very practical. It is easy to do. Here is one example of an actual claim, a Measure 37 claim, in the Central Willamette Valley. The first line is, the, in terms of the before and after, the after value, the value of the property in 2005, $1.2 million. The before value is also available from some records. In 1968, it was worth $190,000. But, of course, a dollar today and a dollar in 1968 is not the same, so we need to adjust for inflation. So we're comparing real or inflation-adjusted dollars. The CPI deflator between these two time periods is 0.181. We divide the before value by that number, and we get an inflation-adjusted before value of $1.05 million. So in this case, we see that the after value, the current value, is a little bit higher than the initial value. Thus, using the before and after method, in this case you would conclude no evidence of a reduction in value. The after value is at least as high as the before value. The shortcoming of the before and after method is that it does not isolate the effects of the land use regulation from the effects of other changes that happen over time in an economy. As a result, the before and after method will sometimes also produce an incorrect result, like the single exemption method. But how often will they err? How often will you get the wrong result, a result that doesn't reflect what perfect information would tell us should be the case here? And for under what kinds of circumstances? Well, I wanted to have a better understanding of how often these methods produce incorrect results. By that I mean approving a claim that is valid and denying a claim, approving a claim that is valid would be a correct result, and denying a claim that is invalid would be the correct result. So to answer this question, I considered a range of scenarios, and the detailed analysis of how I came up with the range of scenarios is in the paper titled Three Methods for Evaluating Measure 37 Claims. I considered cases where the effect of the land use regulation was negative, cases where it was positive, and cases where it was neutral. I considered situations where other factors in the economy were raising land prices, lowering land prices, or neutral as with respect to land prices. When I combined these different combinations of factors, I ended up with 12 scenarios, and I looked at each of these methods and looked at each of these scenarios to answer the question, in which of these scenarios would each method get the answer right? Well, here's I'm not going to go over this table, but this is a sort of the full table of those 12 methods that's in that paper. I think these results are quite important. The results for the impractical with and without method, the perfect method if we had a perfect economic model to compare the hypothetical without scenario with the real world scenario. But in principle, it could produce the correct result 100% of the time if we had really, really good models to use. The single exemption or appraisal method produces a correct result only 33% of the time among these 12 scenarios, whereas the before and after method produces a correct result 75% of the time among these 12 scenarios. Indeed, a closer look reveals that while the before and after method may err in either direction, the single exemption method will always err by approving a claim that is not valid. In fact, the single exemption method always concludes that this Measure 37 claim is valid. On this point, I can come back later with some additional explanation. Now let me turn to a couple of issues that I think deserve closer scrutiny and a little more explanation. The first issue is that some people seem to doubt that land use regulations can actually increase property values. I can say that many studies from around the country have documented this fact. Many land use regulations are intended to separate incompatible land uses, and to bring compatible land uses together, to reduce uncertainty, to avoid conflict, to lower the cost of government services by limiting sprawl, and increase the amenities from surrounding land uses, and to coordinate land use choices with the provision of government services and infrastructure. Such effects have been documented many times. In fact, a recent study of environmental zoning in residential neighborhoods of Portland by Reed College professor Noel Nedizel is just one example. Professor Nedizel studied the effects of environmental zoning on housing values in Portland. She did a very sophisticated data analysis with a very large sample of data. She found that the effect of the land use regulation in some of these residential environmental zones was positive. She also found, however, in some cases, no evidence of an effect either way, and in some cases, some evidence of a negative effect. A point to keep in mind here is that if you use the single exemption approach for evaluating the effect of land use regulations in any of these residential zones in Portland, it would always conclude that the effect was negative, even in those areas of Portland where the effect indeed was positive. The reason for that is that environmental zoning, say, that limits the footprint of your house and doesn't allow you to add on an addition or fill in a wetland to build a swimming pool in the backyard, if you had a waiver, an exemption, and were able to do those things, your property would be worth more. A restriction would be removed for you. You would have more flexibility, and that is likely to increase the value of your land. But the fact that the neighborhood zoning coordinated and protected the environment in the neighborhood overall, and that made that neighborhood overall more attractive and bid up the prices of housing, is still true, even though a single exemption for you would make your property worth even more. The second issue I want to come to, I want to carefully explain why the single exemption method is based on flawed reasoning, which leads to illogical conclusions in some cases. Let me start with an example or a metaphor that's described also in the other short publication that I passed around. Consider OPEC countries. OPEC is a metaphor, but I think it illustrates a basic point. Members of OPEC agree to restrict their oil exports. These export quotas, a kind of regulation, drive up the price of oil on the world market, which in turn increases per barrel oil profits. Nevertheless, applying something like the single exemption method, OPEC member country A might claim that these quotas reduce their profits. After all, they could point out, if they alone could export more oil at the current high price, they could earn more profits. So taking a single exemption approach, they see that oil, that export quota, as reducing the value to them, their oil profits. Well, it should be obvious in this case that if the restrictions on exports were eliminated for all countries, they would all export more, the oil price would drop, and none of them would earn all those extra profits that were so tempting. But those high prices and tempting additional export profits were only there because of those export quotas and restrictions. Thus, the quota has increased, not reduced, country A's profits. Now, let me turn to a hypothetical example to continue along the same reasoning about the single exemption method and why it's problematic in many circumstances. Suppose a city had an urban growth boundary. I'm creating a hypothetical case here to try to clarify this point. Suppose a city had an urban growth boundary like the one in this slide, just adequate for there to be just enough land for the demand for development. Okay, all the lands inside that urban growth boundary are developed, and that's just enough to meet the demand in this city. Well, now let's assume that the demand for developable lands is actually a little bit higher, just enough for one additional subdivision, like the one I've indicated here at the bottom of the slide, but no more than that. the landowner of that parcel might recognize that they could sell their land to a developer if only the UGB were removed. The problem is, other landowners outside that UGB would also, given that situation, knowing that there's some pent-up demand for one additional subdivision, they believe that, gee, if they had an exemption and could sell their land to a developer, they would be able to sell that land at a high price. Indeed, one could imagine all these landowners outside the UGB believing that they were denied a lucrative opportunity because of the urban growth boundary. Why? Because they are using the single exemption method. They are thinking in single exemption terms. They are thinking in terms of the one, but not the many. They are not thinking about what others might do if others also had the opportunity that they were wishing they could have. They have asked the question, or asked an appraiser, the single exemption question, rather than asking the with and without question. Well, this is very hypothetical. How similar is this hypothetical example to the real world? It's very similar. Here's a map, a real map, of the Portland area. The urban growth boundary is there in dark green. The dark red-orange red-orange or orange-shaded areas outside the UGB are Measure 37 claims as of last November. So, indeed, there are probably quite a few additional ones now. But by using the single exemption method, landowners throughout this light red-orange shaded area believe that they have been denied lucrative land development opportunities. But if this were true for all of these lands, Portland would be 3.5 times its current size. The extra lands would jump in value by $26 billion. Is this plausible? No, not by any economic model of supply and demand. Here's just a summary of what I just said. If you believe that the single exemption method tells us what market values would be if the regulations were removed, then you have to believe these things, that removing the regulation would mean the developed area around Portland would grow to 3.6 times its current size, that 650,000 new acres would be developed, and that those new developed lands would be bought at $40,000 an acre for an additional land value surrounding Portland of $26 billion. The reason for this implausible situation is that the single exemption method is being used instead of a with and without method. And just as each OPEC member could not have huge added profits if they were allowed to export more oil, all of these lands where Measure 37 claims have been made would not be developed if the land use regulations were removed. But it also seems to me the case that some of the very strong support for Measure 37, not all, but some of that support comes from people in this outlying area, many of them who believe that they are being denied a lucrative opportunity, but many of them would be sorely disappointed if the land use regulations were actually removed and their illusion would be revealed. Also, this single exemption method has a drawback related to fairness. The estimated value one gets with the single exemption method will often be due in part to the costs that are imposed on neighboring properties. A property surrounded by open space may be more valuable if given an exemption. But the reason the property happens to be surrounded by open space may be precisely because of the land use regulations constraints on the neighbors. As you know, many of the objections to Measure 37 are now being raised now by the neighbors of the claimants. Reliance on the before and after method rather than the single exemption method would reduce the extent of this problem. So let me summarize. Measure 37 imposes an enormous burden on government, requiring them to know the unknowable, by calling for a with and without comparison, which includes a without world that does not exist and we cannot know. Trying to create it in a computer model is potentially possible, but highly impractical. There are, however, two practical alternatives. Each is easy and relatively cheap to undertake. One is based on valid reasoning, the before and after method. One is based on flawed reasoning, the single exemption method. If you think the single exemption approach is a reasonable approach, consider this. Even if we only enacted land use regulations that increased property values, if every land use regulation we enacted raised property values, the single exemption method would still always support approval of Measure 37 claims by leading to a conclusion that the opposite was true, that it actually reduced the property value. Let me repeat that. The single exemption method, even if we only had land use regulations that increased property values, would still approve all Measure 37 claims. Why? Because it is based on some flawed reasoning, on a false presumption. Acceptance of this method based on flawed reasoning could have dangerous and far-reaching implications for Oregon. It would amount to agreeing with the OPEC member country that they have been made worse off because of the export quotas of OPEC. This would be especially troubling since there is a simple, easy alternative that makes a great deal of sense, the before and after method. What should the considerations be for a resolution of this issue? A consistent method, an easy method, a method based on valid reasoning, one that gets it right under most circumstances. If the before and after method were the standard, it would do several important things, it seems to me. First, it would eliminate many claims from people who have seen huge appreciations in the value of their lands, including cases where those gains have been due in part to the land use regulations. Second, it would draw the public's attention to how land values have been trending overall in Oregon, including those subject to land use regulation. It would help people to recognize that in many cases those regulations and other actions by government are complementary and have contributed to that appreciation in value. Of course, the before and after method would also identify cases where land values have been reduced and where they have been reduced because of land use regulations that had that negative effect. And though in those cases they would lead to a decision about either compensation or a waiver. Statewide recognition that the single exemption method does not meet a burden of proof, combined with a shift to uniform reliance on the before and after method, would, in my view, do more than just about anything else you could consider here to resolve the current situation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any members? Questions? We're going to start with Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jager, I read your report earlier today. I'd heard of your method. I disagree with a number of the premises you made in the report. So if I could, I'd like to go through a couple of those with you.
Sure.
First of all, I just got to say, in all my work in real estate and property, you basically throw condemnation law on its head here, because in essence, for 200 plus years in condemnation law, we've used the method that's being used across the state on Measure 37, which is we take a look at the piece of property. If it's zoned industrial, even if it's zoned that way, when we decide we want to buy that for a park, we pay the person based on that compensation. And so I guess what I find unique about your theory here is that if you apply this to all condemnation law, you'd put yourself in a situation where I think you'd have a revolt across this country. I mean, it's not practical in how we've applied condemnation law. I was just wondering if you could just sort of respond to that, because I guess that's what caught me almost off guard, because this is so far afield from anything we've ever done in this kind of law before. So
sure. The example you described is completely different than what I was talking about. In the case of condemnation law, what you want to do is compensate the person for the value that piece of property currently has, okay? And that is very different than saying, what would that property be worth if we removed a land use regulation that applies to that property and perhaps hundreds or thousands of other properties? That's a hypothetical question that economists might try to answer by thinking about markets and supply and demand. If you talk to an appraiser and ask them, do your standard appraisal techniques permit you to say what happens in a land market if there is a significant increase or decrease in the supply or in the demand, they will say, we don't do that. We can't do that. We don't have the tools to do that. And so that is a very different question than saying, if we're going to condemn a piece of property, what is it worth right now? We should pay that person that amount. So I agree completely that for condemnation, what you're suggesting is the right way to do it. This is a different question.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up on that. Let's just put it in exactly the same terms then. An appraiser could go into your condemnation case and say, well, what would be the value of this property if there were no restrictions on industrial land? Hypothetically, and I'm putting this exactly in your terms, you'd say, hypothetically, let's say right now there's 200 acres of industrial land inside of a particular urban growth boundary. We're condemning that piece of property. What if there was no industrially zoned land? I mean, what if everything was zoned industrial? Therefore, this property value would be half of what is currently being triggered. And so, therefore, I mean, I guess what you're asking the appraiser right now to do that exact same thing. Isn't it? What you're doing is that you're assuming a market that is restricted when you pay that person. And it's exactly the same situation that jurisdictions all over the state are using, that you're assuming that all the surrounding properties are restricted. That's the premise upon which condemnation law and Measure 37 are based off of. Every appraisal is based off of the concept, the premise, that every surrounding property is somehow restricted and you have to appraise it based within that environment. So I'm not quite following you on that.
Yeah, again, you're talking about an individual property and the value of that property if it were taken away from somebody or taken away. That is the single exemption or single property question, and that's what appraisers do. The Measure 37 says, was there a reduction in value caused by enactment and enforcement of the land use regulation? Enactment and enforcement of a land use regulation affects many properties. Markets for land, the price in any market is determined by supply and demand. When you change the supply up or down, it's going to affect that equilibrium market price. Appraisers do not go there. They don't answer that question. They recognize that it's not a question that they have the tools to answer.
And Mr. Chair, following on that same, if I could. So the way to solve the question, I mean, in your scenario, the way to solve that exact question is, would then for this body then to lift all of the EFU forest land zoning that's on 97% of all the private rural land in the state, and then you would get to your equilibrium. But we're based in a situation, just like the appraiser is on the industrial zone land with ODOT or for a park, of the entire state being regulated under a system that we've all agreed to, which means we've agreed to it. And what Measure 37 does, it says, basically, under that market condition, if you've reduced their property value, and if you read the clear language of Measure 37, it talks about that specific piece of property. It's exactly the same situation as traditional condemnation. And so what you've done is, what we're left in the situation is that we could lift all the regulations on everybody else's property, and then your logic would be correct. But since we're not about to do that, then your whole premise of your argument from behind this article, as I can read, doesn't make any sense.
Okay, you've covered it three times. I'm going to let him respond. Then I'm going to go to someone else because I would say you've asked it three times. He's answered twice. We're going to hear a third time, and then we're going to move on. And you can come back if you want.
I was listening to a radio show Sunday. Dave Honeycutt was speaking, and he said that the wording in Measure 37 really asks the with and without question. That's what I said, too. The with and without question suggest that we have to try to understand what would those market equilibrium prices be, what would the world look like if without that land use regulation. And that's a market change. You need to try to think through what would be different if the supply and demand in related land markets were different. It's a very complex question. It is not an appraiser's question.
All right, we'll come back if you'd like. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's called well, I'm trying to remember your three terms now. Well, the one you described is the third option. Is it before and after?
Yes.
In it, you essentially use a CPI factor to adjust from the time period, you know, back in the 70s, let's say, if a particular claim was made up till now. What I'm wondering about, I mean, obviously there's a debate about the formula on real estate value versus just the cost of living value. I understand that. I'm wondering if your formula took into account something that we had some testimony that, and I brought one example of a gentleman who, his land is now taxed, well, it's a $356,000 real market value. Because of the farm deferral, it's taxed at $559, and the gentleman pays $7.11 worth of taxes per year on $356,000 worth of value. Is that factored in to your formula that they haven't paid the same taxes everybody else pays, and does that work against maybe other factors like the real estate value?
It is a factor. I'm not sure how large it is. I know there are some other people who've collected a lot of data and analyzed that, and I've looked at some of that data. It certainly could affect the amount. If we were trying to use this method to estimate the precise amount for compensation, mm-hmm. it would be a factor to take into account. But what I'm trying to focus on here is not to come up with some exact amount as potential compensation, but just an up or down piece of evidence. Is there evidence of a reduction in value or not? Is there evidence that the Measure 37 claim is valid or not?
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. I first of all, appreciate you engaging in this work. I mean, this valuation question is a huge one. And, you know, even though I'm an Oregon State alumni and I like extension anyway, I'm really thankful that you've taken the time. I've read through even the 26-pager of yours. Ooh. So my question, I guess, becomes... No, I've forgotten my question. All my excitement about extension.
That's right.
Yeah, well, come back.
We'll come back. Anyone else? Representative McPherson.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah.
Right.
Representative Clem, if you
remember.
Question, go ahead.
When we use the term wrong, how do we know it's wrong? What does wrong mean?
Yeah,
that's my question.
Very, very good. I'm glad you asked that because I was a little uncomfortable with the wording I use, but I wanted to keep it simple. What I have meant when I'm talking about right or wrong is in the three methods paper, you'll see in the appendix a bunch of graphs that characterize different scenarios. And I'm assuming in those scenarios that I'm omniscient, I have a crystal ball, I know exactly what's going on, and I know whether or not in each of those scenarios there was or was not a reduction in value caused by the land use regulation. And then I'm comparing the method, each of those three methods. Does the result of that method correspond to that underlying reality that I've sort of created hypothetically in approving a Measure 37 claim when it is in fact valid as I've defined it in that scenario, or denying the Measure 37 claim in the case where it should be denied. So mm-hmm. It's in that sense. It's if we could really do
with
perfectly
and without,
the with and
right.
without,
yeah.
would these other two imperfect methods come to the same conclusion as the perfect with and without?
That makes sense. Thank you.
Co-Chair McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chager, you described the before and after method as being relatively easy to perform. Most of our claims are for lands that are outside urban growth boundaries that 30 years ago approximately were then committed to by land use restrictions to farm and forest use that were previously available to have rural residences on them. What is the data on which valuation before and after that change occurred roughly 30 years ago? What is the source of data? How readily available is it? How reliable do you think it is?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. We have current data and we have the CPI, so it's that third piece of information that we would need for before and after. How do we come up with a number, an estimate, or the actual price of a property back in, say, the 60s or early 70s? I have done some of this. I've talked to a lot of people about it. Appraisers can do that. They can go back and either find the information or actually go back and historically find some comparable sales and estimate it. Title companies can do the same thing. We have done that with under a research project funded by Oregon Community Foundation. We've been collecting data from six counties, four in Oregon and two in Washington. We're not quite finished with that study, but what we did in Lane and Jackson County, we took samples of about 100 parcels of vacant land with different zones, different distances, and we took the current, we identified them based on current data, and then we went back, and in fact I have some slides here that have made some adjustments of subsamples of those properties in different areas, and looked at how they have grown in value over that period of time. So in some cases it could be challenging, and in some cases it would be easy. I think in quite a few cases people on their own are going to know about what the value of their land was in the 1960s. They're going to be able to look up the CPI and do the adjustment in their head, and many people might decide not to make a claim because they recognize that it's now actually worth more in real dollars than it was in the 1960s.
If I could follow up on the, I want to probe the CPI deflator.
Yes.
And Representative Clem's question actually referred to this question, but what CPI is it? I know that there are different CPIs that are used for different localities around the country. Right. Some of them exclude certain items from the CPI. What is this based on?
What we have used is just the standard national consumer price index. There are regional indices. There are urban indices. They differ a little bit. The Portland Metro Council, what they did in evaluating the Measure 37 claims that came before them, they did the conversion with several different indices, and I believe in most cases found that they all led to the same, the answer, the conclusion, the relative values between the before and after didn't switch with one index versus another. Some people have suggested, oh, you should use some kind of a Portland urban index or an index of housing prices. That would sort of be self-referential. If land use regulations have affected housing, land and housing prices, mm-hmm. then the index
would be impacted.
Includes that. And so you're sort of going in a circle. So I don't think there's a good argument for using something like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Question on the before and after.
Yeah.
In professional sports, the price that's paid to a ball player is often dictated by the price paid to another ball player, arbitration, etc. Let's say that you and I both own 100 acres of land. We're about a half mile apart. And under the before and after, you're evaluating, let's say, my property worth $90,000. But I strike a pretty good deal, and I sell it for $500,000. Doesn't that affect, at that point in time, the value of your land? In other words, your land went from $90,000 to $500,000 right along with mine.
If you sold your land for $500,000, then suddenly my land would be worth that amount, too.
Yes.
I think economists would say no, not as a general principle. I think economists would say economists talk about market prices. And what we think we can say something about are transactions in markets where there are many buyers and many sellers. Okay? And good information. We know in real estate, all it takes is one buyer or one seller to come up with a price that's quite an outlier, high or low, compared to the market price. So unique unique transactions, transactions that appear not to be in line with a trend or with prices in a particular area. That happens. Whether or not that would influence the value of other lands in the vicinity, the only way that I can see that happening is because it would alter people's expectations. Expectations can be on target. Sometimes expectations can miss the mark.
Follow, Mr. Co-Chair?
You may.
If I've got a house for sale in a subdivision, one of the things real estate will do is bring to you the price of the latest houses sold in that subdivision so that you can give an accurate estimate of what your asking price for your home, correct? So,
yes.
Therefore, the prices of the adjacent land do affect the price that I'm able to market my property at.
If I can, I think, again, what you're referring to is a way of giving a seller an idea of what they might expect to get for their house based on comparable sales, on the way the market has gone recently in that vicinity for comparable kinds of properties. That doesn't affect the market price in a direct way. Again, it may affect expectations, but I think people recognize that if they find somebody who really, really wants their house and no other house, they might get something out of line with the norm, out of line with that comparable sales number.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? I've got two in the queue, and I just want to see if anyone else wanted it. All right. Senator George, next.
Right.
All right. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think possibly the other night we heard a discussion of what might be somewhere in between what I hear discussed in terms of condemnation. We're talking about market value then. And part of why you're talking about market value is because you're going to lose the property when it's over. So you don't have anything left when it's over because it's gone to the government entity. Here, and if your property's been regulated, you still have something left. So it hasn't been condemned. But the market value captures essentially what you will lose, which is the whole thing. Before and after doesn't factor in any sort of real estate market factor for what's happened. It's just straight cost of living, which is milk and all kinds of other factors. In between, it seems like there's something that we heard talked about the other night called the development rights. And development rights are something where you still have the underlying land, but society is asking you not to develop it. And so is there another price that is the opportunity cost of not developing your land, even though you still own the underlying land? It's the opportunity cost of not developing it, you know, maybe subtract out your property tax breaks you got from the rest of us for the last 30 years. I guess I didn't really ask you a question, did I?
What caught my attention in listening to what you were saying, one of the main messages that I would like to get across is that these market values or market prices are the result of a complex interaction of supply and demand and a lot of choices and decisions. If you're talking about, well, can we separate a development right from the land right, the value of that development right is also affected by and the result of all the kinds of land use restrictions and regulations, not just in that particular area, but even neighboring areas. If someone wants to get compensated for the development right for some land outside of Coburg where they can't develop, it may be that development right, if you ask an appraiser, is quite high. Why is it high? It may be high because of land use regulations around Coburg. It may be high because of the urban growth boundary and regulations around Eugene or Springfield or Junction City. So the interaction of all these land use regulations that affect supply and demand and can raise or lower values of properties, it's a very complex story. And separating out that development right doesn't change the fact that the estimate of what that development value might have been worth
mm-hmm.
is a product of all these market and regulatory decisions and government services and investments, including the possibility that it's high because of land use regulations and, right. and how that's affected over time.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you. I guess the first thing is your with or without method is the one that you say if you could do it, it is always correct.
That's right.
And
you
so
do it perfectly.
Right. Yeah. And so I guess my thing would be right now we have the situation where there's the opposite of that is that you have the single restriction. Totally, I mean, really from my perspective, I understand this, the opposite. When we look at all of the Measure 37 claims that are located in a particular county like the one you had, yeah, like this, and is there a way to say, okay, we've just done it to all of those values? I mean, everyone, if you just took the 37 claims, all of a sudden you've put a whole bunch of property on the market at one time. And from my perspective, that has to diminish the value of any one of them. Not as much as the whole regulation off of all of the land, but considerably different. And so the issue is that you want to get your first one out there because if you get to develop yours first, yours is worth a whole lot more, and this other person who develops it much later is going to lose a whole lot of value with regard to that. What he thought his claim was worth becomes much, much less down if he's at the end of the line. Because all of a sudden there's a flooded market. Is there a way to figure out the value of the lands considering all of the 37, not the others, but if you remove the deal from all of those 37 claims, what's the adjunct value at that particular time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are some crude ways that you could come up with some estimate. There are estimates of the what we call the supply elastic, how elastic the supply or the demand is. And if you increase the supply, what downward pressure would there be on prices? I've talked with some people up at Portland. They have some models, and I've talked about trying to do that. And one could do a rough estimate fairly easily. And you're right, it would mean those land prices wouldn't sell for $40,000. They would sell for a lower price, and some portion of them would likely not be developed at all. One thing I skipped over in that's related to your question, and I think reinforces the troubling implications of relying on the single exemption method and believing it to be the with and without method. In this map, you see a lot of dark green areas inside the urban growth boundary. Those are vacant properties. So you have about 28,000 acres of vacant land inside the urban growth boundary. If you approve all those dark orange, red Measure 37 claims outside of the urban growth boundary, it's pretty clear that all those people who have vacant land inside the urban growth boundary are going to suffer a significant loss. And so that just reinforces the fact that you need to think about markets. You need to think about supply and demand and price. The single exemption method does not do that. The single exemption method takes for granted, takes as given, all the effects that have already, everything as it is, and looks for the potential gain of an individual landowner in that existing situation.
George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Representative Clem actually kind of got to the core of my point, and I appreciate it, but I waited. I guess herein lies my problem, is that when we talk about development rights, which is what we're actually talking about when we take a partial takings of a person's property through regulation, which is what Measure 37 addresses, is the whole issue of partial regulatory takings. And so when you look at a public policy decision that we've made, which is this body has made, the Land Conservation Development Commission, with rule authority that we've granted them, have made policy decisions that we have made that has certain implications. In the original legislation that was adopted in 1973, the entire land use package, there was a part of the land use package was a Senate bill called Senate Bill 849, which looks very similar to Measure 37. It was put forward by the authors of Senate Bill 100 and 101, and in fact, before the committee, they discussed the fact that this needed to be passed out. And it was also included in Section 24 of Senate Bill 100 that we would have compensation for in essence, regulatory takings. And there was actually a lengthy discussion. This is some background. That there was a lengthy discussion by the governor's staff about exactly how this would work. And what's amazing about it is you listen to the governor's discussion at the time, Governor Tom McCall, he actually discussed the fact that it was very, very similar to Measure 37. So that wasn't done then. So now we're dealing with 30 years of regulations. And what the people said at the ballot box, if you read the clear language of the law, and I don't know if you've got to read the case so far by Judge Dickey that discusses sort of the, some of these issues you've brought up, clearly what we're trying to do is go back and say to those folks, we're trying to grandfather them in. We're trying to grandfather in their uses through Measure 37. It's a simple term of what we're doing. Therefore, what you have are you have people who are being who still own their property, who were not compensated under a bill that didn't pass 849 or Section 24 of Senate Bill 100 through a series of decisions that we've made. And what we end up with at the end of the day is the only way to appraise these people's values based on what uses they lost and what that market would value would be today. And so I guess you're talking about an environment upon where we lift all regulations and we value it, and then we put the regulations back on top. That's not the world we're living in. In essence, that's what you're discussing. So if we clear up for me.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm being a bit argumentative because I'm trying to...
Yeah, I'm talking.
I never suggested removing all regulations all at once in some hypothetical way. What we're talking about in any case for any claim is removing a single regulation and thinking about removing a single regulation and thinking about how the world would be different if we removed that single regulation from all the properties that are affected by that single regulation. That's very different than what you've characterized my proposal as, and it's not that. I think perhaps we may be discussing or thinking about different examples. When you talk about partial takings, if we have an example that's a partial taking, then the value of that land is going to be less after than before, and they're going to deserve compensation or a waiver. Let me give two examples. An example of what economists call a public good or a benefit, a regulation that is intended to benefit the general public or for visibility or protecting the scenery of the Columbia Gorge or something like that. It doesn't, and that benefit is to society generally. It does not end up being capitalized in the land value. The owner does not benefit. That would be a case where you, before and after, you would see that the land would be worth less if you told people, no, you can't build here because we like the scenery. Everyone around the state likes the scenery. We don't want it to have something built there. So that would be a case where before and after would be consistent with what you're suggesting about a partial taking. Another example would be some municipality that had grandiose ideas about an industrial park, and they zoned a huge area thinking, you know, if you build it, they will come. And a lot of area that wasn't needed, the industries didn't come, that land ended up being idle, and those prices for the land under that zoning went way down. Again, before and after would identify that and say, this person has seen a loss in value because of the land use regulation. We should either compensate or waive. So those two examples are ones where I don't think you and I are seeing it any differently. But the other examples that it seemed like you were alluding to are ones where it's very difficult to know if it weren't for a land use regulation, what would the benefit or the value of that property be without thinking about all those interconnected decisions by government and regulations. If the regulation in my neighborhood that keeps people from building six-story homes, if that makes my neighborhood an attractive place to live, my value goes up. There's no partial taking. There's a partial benefit. And I shouldn't have to. So if I'm, let's say I'm in that neighborhood and it says two-story maximum house, and it's an attractive place, a lot of people want to live there, and the housing prices are high. My neighbor could go and say, hey, I want to build a five-story house, and because I can't, that reduces my property's value, because if I had a five-story house, I'd have the only one in the neighborhood, I would have great views, I'd be better off. So therefore, obviously, an appraiser will tell me that my land would be worth more if I could build a five-story house. Therefore, I demand a compensation or a waiver so that I can build the only five-story house in the neighborhood. So there's an incompatibility there with the perception of what a single exemption could bring you and what the regulation did for everybody as a group. in an area where the land use regulations, in many cases, not all cases, may have benefited the community.
One last follow-up.
Okay.
I don't actually disagree, because we get into situations where we're talking about you put in a highway and you have people who have benefits due to government actions. And under no circumstances am I not saying that that's an accurate reflection, that there are certain spillover effects by government actions that benefit property owners all the time. That I'm not even discussing. But where we're missing each other, I guess, and this is maybe something we can discuss outside the committee, and maybe we can get together sometime and talk and discuss it. But what your problem with your valuation and the premise of it is that you're taking people who had a regulatory effect that affected what uses they could use on that property, and then you're applying it to in essence a holistic view, as if we haven't made, as if this body hasn't made policy decisions, and the Land Conservation Development Commission hasn't made policy decisions, and saying, well, if they hadn't made those, then there wouldn't be a loss. And I guess what I'm saying is today there is a loss, and therefore you have to take a look at an isolated situation based on the passage of Measure 37. Explain to me why I'm mistaken there, if you could.
Your presumption that there is a loss is one that I would need to see proved. Because the world is complicated and land markets are all over the place.
I guess I'm saying loss of use. There's a loss of use, therefore
okay.
You have,
all right.
You lose the use inherent.
Okay, so if it wasn't used for that purpose before the regulation went into effect, and if when the regulation went into effect, the loss of that potential use was, if that somehow was the highest and best use, we should have seen a drop in the value right after that regulation went into effect. A follow-up to the before and after that looks at sort of when you bought it and today is to say, well, if we don't think that really gets at, or if there's too much that has gone on in the economy so that long 30-year time period doesn't really answer the question satisfactorily, let's look at just before and just after the time when the regulation went into effect, the year before and the year after. Then, in the case in the illustration you just gave, we ought to see a drop in value when that regulation went into, say, the year before to the year after. We ought to see that drop then, and that would be a follow up that one could also think about doing. The reason I stuck to the idea of sort of a current value, because I think the right before and right after is probably the best way to do it. Measure 37 has some language about as of the day the claim is made, and so
application.
The application, and lawyers tell me that means that that's where the after date has to be placed.
Let me ask you a question. In a sense of the three models that you have, if you had someone that was involved in an accident, personal injury, and you were going to apply one of the models, I mean. Which of the three, or are there more than one that would be more to what we see in the courts use now as to try to make someone whole based on their loss?
Well, yeah, I have difficulty with the analogy because one person has a loss. If one person is in an accident and they have a loss, say if someone hit them or caused their injury, they have a loss and you caused that injury. That's not a market-wide effect. That's an individual. That's an example that really is tied to a single person, and there are no market effects to consider in that hypothetical.
Okay, just want to clarify.
Yeah.
Representative Roblin, and then Professor, I know that you have other commitments. Just check in on time. It's a little bit after 6. I told you we'd get you out of here around 6.
I'm fine.
Okay. We're going to wrap it up, though. But
thank you, Chair. My question goes back to the answer you just gave just a moment ago, and that is, you know, part of this comes about that we all talk about Senate Bill 100 and the fact that they didn't do the compensation part at the time. And what I heard you say is that it would be relatively easy to figure out what that regulation effect was within that year. So before and then a year later, and the numbers are out there, so you could figure out what the loss was. And then you could actually go back and say, given if I gave that money, say it was $100, and we've now had 30 years. They didn't get the $100 in. We own their interest. You could come up with a value that they actually lost because of that regulation back in 1968. Or didn't lose, because, I mean, it's very possible that the property value for that limited use got greater the following year.
Yeah, I think that would come closer. I mean, there are still markets, especially markets for things like land, are influenced greatly by expectations. So you might think, well, when was the point in time when people realized that this regulation was in fact going to be enacted and enforced? You would want a measure of the price before those expectations changed, and then after those expectations were sort of fully realized. There may have been other things going on in the world, in the markets. If you got lucky, maybe the economy was fairly stable. And so comparing a year before and a year after would give you a very good test, and you could, with some confidence, come up with a good estimate of that of the reduction in value if there was one there to observe with those changes in prices. If the regulation went into effect on the same year as a recession, then you still have a problem. But I think in many cases that would be very useful evidence and certainly a more The thing with the before and after is it's actually like the with and without. Okay. At one point in time, you were without the regulation, and at another point in time, you were with the regulation. So it is a with and without. It's just that there's a big time. If there's a big right. time period in between, there are other things going on, and you implicitly sort of assumes that those things sort of netted out, and that's clearly not the case over a 30-year period. So if you can narrow the time frame, you're going to more often get a good fix on what happened due to the land use regulation.
Okay. And our last question will be from Representative Klim. Last question.
Thank you.
Uno.
Yeah.
One.
This one.
I have one for you after we've excused him.
That's been great.
You know, you said something in your comments somewhere in there that I just wanted to key in on. Senator Georgian mentioned sort of the concept of grandfathering. And it sounded to me like you read the measure more the way I did initially, where you said, you know, the words of the measure said, government shall compensate. And grandfathering was, if you can't compensate, then you grandfather. But all the testimony we've heard over the last several months has been the assumption that we couldn't value and then compensate, so therefore you grandfather. But when I voted, you know, when I voted on the thing, I thought somebody was going to get a check after a fair valuation process. I thought they were going to get a check for some money due. And if we didn't write the check, that's when we got into grandfathering. And I thought I heard you say something like that. Is that how you sort of based getting started in this whole deal to begin with?
I guess initially we did focus more on the question. We started with the question, how would you go about coming up with an accurate estimate of the amount of compensation? Over time, it's been clear that for political reasons, compensation seems not to be in the cards in many cases. So I guess I don't have an opinion or any expert interpretation on the compensation versus waiver part of it. And I, in this case, at this point in time, focused more on a rule that might be practical and easy that could make that up or down decision about whether the waiver is justified or not.
Professor Jaeger, I want to thank you very much for being here tonight and giving us your perspective on the evaluation of Measure 37 claims. And so thank you very much. And if there's other comments or feedback that members would like to have or opportunity to have a more lively discussion with the professor, I assume he'll be willing to do so. Senator.
Mr. Chair, just before the professor leaves, I wanted to ask him, there are some other valuation hypotheses floating around. Have you had any consultation with others who are working on valuation methodologies or philosophies?
Just my colleague Andrew Plantinga is the only one I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Professor Jaeger, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're going to go ahead and let's see. Oh, I guess we've got some good news. We've been working diligently. We're going to take a break, and we'll have this Thursday off as a committee. And so plan accordingly. The co-chairs, we're very appreciative of all the long hours that we put in and ones that have gone over the allotted time that we've had, and so we hope that you'll make good use of your time. With that, the committee is going to close unless there's anything else from Co-Chair McPherson.
No, that's fine.
We'll be adjourned.